This is Larry Jones. You are listening to the Grace and Glory Hour with Pastor David M. Atkinson. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate your interest and request that you pray for this ministry. Our email address is graceglory7@juno.com. graceglory7@juno.com. Now here is Pastor Atkinson.
Mark 6:14. And King Herod heard of him. Now that pronoun refers to the Lord Jesus. King Herod heard of Jesus, for his name was spread abroad. And Herod said that John the Baptist was risen from the dead. And therefore, mighty works do show forth themselves in him. Others said that it is Elias. And others said that it is a prophet, or as one of the prophets. But when Herod heard thereof, he said, "It is John, whom I beheaded." Now, put those two phrases together. Do they make a lot of sense to you? This one that's out there preaching is John, whom I beheaded. As they say today, this does not compute. But sin leads us to positions and statements that do not make sense. Sin, which is rebellion against God, leads us to make irrational choices and irrational statements. This one who's out there preaching is John, whom I beheaded. He's risen from the dead. Now watch this. This is a flashback. You are familiar with the flashback technique in either a novel, a book, or in a movie. Beginning at verse 17, we have a flashback. For we're going back in time to be caught up on the history that led up to Herod's foolish, irrational conclusion. Here it is. For Herod himself had, past tense, Herod himself had sent forth and laid hold upon John and bound him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife. Here is a sin at the bottom of it all. He had bound John in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. For John had said unto Herod, "It is not lawful for thee to have thy brother's wife." Therefore, Herodias had a quarrel against John and would have killed him, but she could not, for Herod feared John. The wife that he stole from his brother hated John, but Herod feared him. And that's going to put tension in these developments. There is a tension here. There's a tension here between what Herod would have liked to have done and what this stolen wife wanted. Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just man and unholy. And Herod observed him, John. And when Herod heard John, he, Herod, did many things and heard him gladly. When he heard John, he did many things and heard him gladly. And when a convenient, opportune day was come, that Herod on his birthday made a supper to his lords, high captains and chief estates of Galilee. And when the daughter of the said, or the aforementioned Herodias, the daughter to the previous marriage, when the daughter of the said Herodias came in and danced, this was not couples dancing, this was Mid-Eastern dancing. We would probably call it a folk dancing, and it did not have to be sensual. But depending on how you did the Mideastern interpretive folk dancing, it could be sensual. Indeed, it could be erotic. When the daughter of the stolen wife came in, the daughter from the previous marriage, and danced and pleased Herod and them that sat with him, the king said unto the damsel, ask of me whatsoever thou wilt, and I will give it thee. And he sware unto her, whatsoever thou shalt ask of me, I will give it thee unto the half of my kingdom. And she went forth and said to her mother, oh my, she said to her mother, what shall I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. Now come to verse 27. And immediately the king, Herod, sent an executioner and commanded his head to be brought. And he went and beheaded John in the prison and brought his head in a charger on a platter and gave it to the damsel. Let me point out that the previous chapter, Mark 5, tells us that this term damsel referred to a girl about 12. Now, you don't have to trust me on it. Just read toward the end of Mark 5, and you'll see that this term damsel referred to a young girl about 12. And the executioner gave the head of John the Baptist to the 12-year-old damsel, and the damsel gave it to her mother. Our text is Mark 6, 28. For Herod, King Herod, feared John the Baptist. The king feared John. Do you recall that in another time and place, another John was feared by another earthly sovereign? I'm asking you to remember your history, and especially your Reformation history from the mid-1500s. Do you recall that in another time and another place, another John was feared by another earthly sovereign? In the mid-1500s AD, in response to John Knox's imprecatory prayers, Mary, Queen of Scots, is reported to have said, I fear the prayers of John Knox more than all the assembled armies of Europe. I fear the prayers of John Knox more than all the assembled armies of Europe. Now that is a serious fear. Herod had a serious fear of John the Baptist, and Mary, Queen of Scots, had a serious fear of John Knox. It requires little or no speculation to suppose that John the Baptist prayed for and about King Herod and his illegitimate wife. Even as later John Knox would pray for and about Mary, Queen of Scots, so I believe John the Baptist prayed for and about King Herod and Herodias, the illegitimate wife. Oh my. Oh my. What fire there would have been in that praying. Can you imagine John the Baptizer clothed in a skin and eating locusts, grasshoppers, living out in the deserted places by the Jordan River? Can you imagine John getting down on his knees and beginning, now, Yahweh, Jehovah. It is about this wicked king and his stolen wife. Jehovah, don't you see? Don't you know? Can you imagine the fire when John the Baptizer prayed for and about King Herod and that illegitimate queen Herodias? I was going to say I would like to have been listening in the bush, but I'm not sure I would like to have been listening in the bush to hear the baptizer pray for and about this wicked, profligate, debauched king and his illegitimate wife. That kind of John the Baptist praying would have withered the presumptuous frivolity of most profligates, but not Herod, because Herod had become incorrigible. Herod had passed the line, and Herod would henceforth experience symptoms, but he would never come to biblical repentance, and all the praying that John the Baptizer did could not shake Herod out of his libertine lifestyle and his profligacy. Not even the praying of that great godly man could shake Herod from his chosen course of depravity. This account before us is testimony, and write in bold letters beside this section, write the words, "The testimony of John the Baptist." This account is testimony to the finally indomitable and inherent power of righteous living. Write that in your margin. This is a testimony to the finally indomitable and inherent built-in power of righteous living. You just cannot squelch the message of righteous living. Not even if you're king. You cannot stifle. You cannot keep down the testimony of righteous living. You can't force it into a box and keep it there. This account reveals how a simple man in simple clothing with a simple diet, who had little or nothing, ruled over a man who had everything. John the Baptist had little. Read the record. We're not even sure that he had a settled home. He wandered up and down beside the Jordan in deserted places. His attire was very simple. His diet was simple. This account gives us the wonder how a man who had little ruled over a man who had everything. Because the man who had everything feared the man who had virtually nothing. Now go figure. That's the power of consistent, righteous living. You say, well, I could never live in a big home. I could never have a fancy wardrobe. But you can live a righteous life. And you can influence a neighbor, or perhaps a state representative, or perhaps a mayor, or perhaps a senator, or perhaps a governor. You can influence by the power of righteous living. Never sell short the power of righteous living. I'm going to tell you, this is not in my outline. What is going to make the difference in the United States of America is not who wins the election this November. That's not going to make much difference at all, no matter who it is, no matter which of the leaders of the four parties gets into office. It's not going to be the elected president. We'll just rearrange some furniture on the deck. The only thing that can make the difference is the power of righteous lives like you. That's the only thing that God will be able to use to really change America. You just forget putting all your eggs in the Republican Party or the Democrat Party or the Libertarian Party or the Green Party. It's the power of God through righteous lives that change nations. For the Bible says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Stop counting on the politicians and the kings and their queens, and make up your mind that come what may, you at least can live a righteous life to please the Lord, and through that life, you can make a difference, and you may even rule over the ones who have the big fancy titles. Jesus said that there had never been a greater prophet than John the Baptist, Luke 7:28. And John was surely also greater than Herod, because John dominated Herod from the grave. In previous messages from this passage, we've seen how the living man feared the dead man. And we've also observed the young damsel, the 12-year-old. And Josephus tells us that her name was Salome. Her name is not given anywhere in the Bible, but the Jewish historian Josephus says her name was Salome. We've also looked at Salome, the 12-year-old, who was told to dance and did dance. And we've called her an exploited daughter. And she was at that age. It would have been different had she been 25 or 30. But the word does not apply to 25-year-olds and 30-year-olds. Damsel applies to those about 12 years of age. And so we looked at an exploited daughter. Today we consider, and I'll just be able to start it, today we consider how to rule a king from your grave. How to rule a king from your grave. You say, well, I'd like to make a difference. But I'm not wealthy and I'm not rising in politics. I don't have the right connections. I'm going to show you in the next several weeks how to rule a king from your grave. Now, briefly, before we move toward the core of the message, I will offer three more preliminary and undeveloped comments. I think they're significant. I will not develop them. I believe they're significant. Number one, the Holman Study Bible notes that it's ironic that King Herod's birthday was John's death day. Herod's birthday was John's death day. Think about that and the conflict between good and evil, and be like the psalmist who said, I was troubled. I was troubled by the apparent prosperity of evil until I went into the house of the Lord. Herod's birthday with its big party was the righteous man's death day. It doesn't seem fair, does it? God doesn't settle all of his accounts on Friday. Then noticed a second preliminary comment, number two. Herod's foolish and ill-advised vow of verses 22e and 23 remind us of the impulsive vow of Jephthah in Judges chapter 11. Do you remember the judge Jephthah? He was in a spot of pressure. He was facing battle. And he said, "Oh God, I need to win. So God, if you'll let me win, if you'll help me win, I'll sacrifice the first thing that walks out to meet me when I go home." And the first thing that walked out to meet Jephthah when he got home was his daughter. And so this rash, ill-advised oath or vow of Herod ought to remind us of the rash, ill-advised vow of that Old Testament judge. Ladies and gentlemen, it is true that I was raised in what you would probably consider a slightly modernized Mennonite group. I acknowledge that. I've never been ashamed of it. And Mennonites have a special eye on this business of swearing oaths and taking vows. It is important in the Mennonite mind to be very serious when you think about swearing an oath or taking a vow. Let's remember that the Mennonites may be onto something. Look at where the oath and the vow got Jephthah, and look at where the oath and the vow got Herod. Oh, you say, "Well, I don't accept what you're saying. I'm going to continue to swear oaths and vow vows." Well, if that's your choice, you're free to do that, but you better look down the road and contemplate some consequences before you go vowing and swearing oaths as a regular habit. Jesus advised against swearing or oath-taking in Matthew 5, verses 34 through 36. Jesus advised against it. He said, "Your character ought to be such that your yea can be yea and your nay can be nay, and everybody knows that. And you don't have to go overboard swearing oaths or swearing vows to try to reinforce what should be already the integrity of your simple naked word. Just say it. If you have to go around making vows and swearing oaths all the time, it may be that there's some lack of credibility behind your simple words. So just let your yea be yea and your nay be nay, and people can take it or leave it." Herod's rash and casual oath-taking teaches us that oaths taken during moments of euphoria, scintillation. Herod was excited. Now, what way he was excited when he saw this 12-year-old dance, I leave for you to decide. But he was euphoric. He was excited, and he was scintillated, and in the context of being excited, if you will, stirred up, he took an oath. What he did ought to teach us that whether we're euphoric or scintillated or frightened, in despair, as Jephthah was, We need to be careful about swearing oaths. We need to think it through. Oaths have implications. Well, it used to be that a man's word was his bond in America and Canada. And oh, how far from that we've gone. Pastors should not lie. Bankers should not lie. Lawyers should not lie. Politicians should not lie. We should not go around breaking our word, breaking our oaths. So let's be careful about this serious matter of our word. Because oaths taken in a moment of scintillation or desperation can come back to bite us or to haunt us. I'm not one to engage in ghost stories or stories about haunted houses. But Herod's oath came back not only to bite him, but to haunt him. He could not get John the Baptizer out of his mind. He was haunted by both his oath and the consequences. Then number three. I'm looking at really undeveloped preliminary observations. That there's so much here. And I'm not a faithful teacher if I don't give a lot of it to you. You say, well, Pastor, you don't have to dump everything on us. You don't have to dump the whole loaf. Yes, but there are certain parts of the loaf that just beg to be dumped. So I'm dumping. The third preliminary and undeveloped comment is this. While we may wonder whether Herod was exaggerating when he said he'd give this 12-year-old up to half the kingdom, and some say he was just exaggerating because of the scintillation of the moment, while we may wonder whether Herod was exaggerating when he offered Salome up to half the kingdom as a reward for the pleasure of her dancing, it is folly indeed that leads hatred to forfeit half a kingdom for a severed head. Wasn't that folly? He offered her, at least that's what he said, he offered her up to half the kingdom. Instead of taking half the kingdom, she chose a blood-splattered, severed head. Now, what could she do with a severed head? Except eventually let it make its way back to John the Baptist's followers who buried the body. Hatred causes us to make short-sighted, naive, stupid choices. He offered her half of Galilee. She said, I'll take a hit. Now what about me? And what about you? Whom do you passionately hate? Yes, it's time for us to talk turkey. It's time for us to talk about me and you. Whom do you passionately hate? Who is your John the Baptist, because he said you ought not to live that way. Passionate hatred led Herodias to counsel her daughter to choose a severed head instead of half a kingdom. It's a pretty stupid choice. Hatred leads to stupid choices. Come on. And if you keep nursing that hatred, and you're seeing that person's face right now, aren't you? You're seeing the very face of the one that you're so inclined to hate. If you keep hating the way Herodias kept hating John the Baptist, you'll make a very stupid choice as well. You'll forfeit something grand you could have had for a severed, blood-splattered head. That's what hatred does. Now, who is he? Who is she? Let's talk turkey. You can't afford to nurse hatred in your heart for anyone. That's what I said. You can't afford to nurse hatred in your heart for anyone. Perhaps they gave you good advice, even as John the Baptist gave Herod and Herodias good advice. He said, this displeases God. God is opposed to this. Get right. Perhaps that person gave you good advice, scriptural advice, as John the Baptist did to Herod and Herodias. Or perhaps that person gave you not so good advice. But you don't have to hate that person. Hatred that is not dealt with will leave you with a severed head that is subject to what the Apostle Paul called the process of corruption, the decaying of the physical body. Corruption. Hatred that is not dealt with will leave you with a severed head when you could have had much, much more. I understand this is hard preaching. You see, I'm not just listing a list of do's and don'ts. Wear this. Don't wear that. Go here. Don't go there. I'm not just giving us a list of do's and don'ts this morning. I'm talking about our hearts. And I begin with my heart and the temptation to hatred. Christianity is a thing of the heart that moves from the inside out. And we can't expect God to bless us or use us if we have hatred. We'll end up with a very short end of the stick. And in hindsight, it will all look so dumb and so stupid that we gave up half a kingdom for a decaying head.
We trust you have been encouraged or strengthened by the word today. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at graceglory7@juno.com. That's graceglory7@juno.com. We will reply to all those who contact us. And now, until next time, may the good Lord bless and keep you.